Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 5th of April. Coming up on the program, why Johannesburg is the country's corruption capital. A pre-election violence warning from the Independent Electoral Commission. New rules to make it easier for foreign nationals to work in South Africa. Africa's increasing carbon emission problem and the fight to save a popular live stream wildlife channel.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The highest number of complaints about corruption last year came from Gauteng at 37%, according to the NGO Corruption Watch. This was followed, not unsurprisingly, by KwaZulu-Natal, 19%, Free State, 10%, and the Western Cape, 9%. Mohlatsi Komote is legal researcher at Corruption Watch and joins us at the top of the program. And firstly, could you put these percentages into some sort of context for me?
Thank you so much, Jeremy. So just to note that, you know, since our inception as Corruption Watch, we've received a total of about 46,900 reports of corruption. And so in the last year alone, we had noted that there are three main cities, actually, that account for 71% of corruption. And that includes the cities of Joburg and Tshwane. And what we found there was that the most prominent types of corruption were maladministration, bribery, employment irregularities, procurement irregularities as well, and fraud. And so we've just noted that part of the challenge here has been the lack of adequate provision of basic services and rights, which obviously then aids in corruption specifically.
What type of services would we be talking about?
So, for example, we'd be talking about efficient policing, safety and security, employment and education. And just to note that in Gauteng, for example, we do quite a lot of mining work. And so what we noted was that there was quite a lot of malfeasance and wrongdoing in the mining sector at 38%. And that could also perhaps speak to your earlier question around why Gauteng had high numbers of corruption compared to everybody else.
Mohlatsi, are you able to elaborate a little bit more for me on the specific types of maladministration and fraud reported within these sectors?
Yes, I most certainly can. So what we found was, again, the concerns around the policing. So that could be things around, you know, the usual cool drink and everything. And what we've done, or what is referred to as cool drink, what we have done is we have tried to work together to really educate and train the police officers and the different police forums that are available at community level to really speak about these issues, to really try and change our policing, for example. And then with procurement irregularities, it's things like, based on our Procurement Watch tool, it's things like where, for example, a contract or bid is awarded, but it's awarded to a person who's not the correct person, and there's some kind of irregularity or wrongdoing there. So there's quite a lot that we've seen. We've also seen in the basic education sector, you know, where people are paying bribes for employment within that relevant sector. And so those are some of the incidences that we have seen as Corruption Watch, which are a cause for concern for us in particular.
It's interesting to see in the report that corruption in the mining sector, let's go back there if we can, often involves community engagement and social responsibility. What specifically are, or how specifically are communities involved in this? And are there recommendations that you make in terms of improving governance to avoid that?
Yes. So in terms of our sustainable mining work, we have what is known as a REAP project, which really focuses on ensuring that members within these mining affected communities have access to information and are able to engage with the various stakeholders. So what we would do as Corruption Watch is we would go into a community, provide them with information so that community members are able to hold the mining community, mining companies, to account. And so, for example, what we would do is we would advocate for more community participation as per the legislation, social and labor plans, or SLPs as they're commonly referred to. And we've seen that in some instances, what happens in these mining affected communities is that people are actually not, for example, the decisions that are taken on behalf of communities, and people haven't actually adequately engaged on what the mining in that mining affected community would mean for them, would mean for their health, their education of their children, and so forth, and for employment opportunities as well. And so what we are trying to do is to really continue doing this work. We think that there needs to be more collaboration, and we've worked with other organizations such as the Benchmarks Foundation to really take this on and to, where possible, represent communities in instances where we have found corruption or where there are some serious concerns that have been addressed by the community members themselves.
Let me ask you a final question. Is Corruption Watch concerned about the increase in malfeasance ahead of the election at the end of May?
Yes, so we most certainly are. But just to note that, you know, there have been some strides made in a South African context. One of the things that's really important for us is just observing how the whistleblowers play a critical role in the South African context and globally as well. What we've seen as Corruption Watch is that the whistleblowers, regardless of the fact that they might personally face a lot of criticism or they might face, you know, some personal atrocities, they are still willing to come forward and report what is happening at their organizations or in their communities. So one of the things that's really good for us to see is to note the fact that whistleblowers are still coming forward. However, we do think as Corruption Watch that there needs to be more incentives for whistleblowers to come forward. Right. There needs to be more adequate protection. And we're seeing that that's not something that is currently being done in a South African context. And we had engaged with the Department of Justice and others last year in a discussion paper on how we can actually continuously protect the rights of whistleblowers. So we're hoping to see more legislative reform in this regard. And we think that it will be a good way forward. And one of the things, just in closing, I know we're pressed for time, one of the things that we have really engaged in on the public procurement bill, for example, is just noting the fact that incentivized whistleblowing is the right way forward in a South African context. We've seen in other countries that it does work quite well and does offer some level of protection, at least for the whistleblowers. So that's something that we are hoping to see out of these elections when we have a new administration, just to see their deliberate efforts as political parties in ensuring that South Africa becomes a better country.
I am going to leave it there. Motlatsi Komote, thank you very much indeed from Corruption Watch.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Independent Electoral Commission has warned all political parties against inciting violence, intimidation, and spreading false information during their campaigns ahead of the national election at the end of May. I'm joined now by IEC Commissioner Judge Daya Pillay. Judge Pillay, a very warm welcome to you and thank you very much for joining us. There was the signing of the Code of Conduct by the political parties yesterday. What specifically then is the IEC concerned about?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and thanks to the listeners. What we're concerned about is practices that we've observed recently and in the past, where the rhetoric, political rhetoric and campaigning exceeds the bounds of acceptable conduct that is disallowed by the code. The code is quite clear about what candidates and supporters can and cannot do, And all the obvious things they cannot do is resort to violence, incitement, and so on. But the other election-related conduct that they may not do is to force or compel someone to vote or not to vote, or to vote or not to vote for a particular person or party. So there's code of conduct violations that we're concerned about. We're also concerned about violations of the Electoral Act itself. For instance, you cannot impersonate an IEC official. You cannot obstruct the IEC officials from going about their business. And also that both the code violations and violations of provisions of the Electoral Act could result both in penalties from emanating from the Electoral Court and also from the ordinary courts of the land, the Magistrates' Court and the High Court, for as criminal prosecutions. And that could result in fines or imprisonment of up to 10 years. The Electoral Court has a limit of deregistering a party or the candidate.
Judge Pillay, given those concerns and the highly contested nature of this year's election, are you, or do you believe that you will find it more difficult to enforce that electoral code of conduct, or are you satisfied with the way in which you're doing it right now?
Well, the text of the code, as with many legal instruments, is quite clear and in itself would be effective if all the other agencies come to the party. In other words, for anyone to be prosecuted, it requires a complainant, which the IEC can be, the police to arrest, and the courts to hear and prosecute. So if all of those things are lined up, that can happen quite nicely.
You are comfortable that you've got the capacity for that enforcement?
We would be done, yes. And we would be done mostly with this round, this stage of our proceedings in terms of getting the ballot paper ready by the 9th. We would have dealt with all the appeals, and by the 18th, we would be issuing certificates to candidates. So that round of contestation, we hope, would sort of calm down. But we're also already dealing with code of conduct violations. And although we've not been very visible in terms of addressing it in terms of court papers as yet, we have been talking to political parties, and our engagement, not only now but in previous elections, has always been to try and conciliate and get buy-in of the cooperation of the political parties and their supporters rather than litigating. You must remember that they are also our social partners and stakeholders, and we want to be a service rather than a stick to whack them every time they go out of line. Let no mistake be made about the powers of the commission in terms of prosecuting its the rules and the code. And it might mean that we will have to make an example or two, and we're quite capable of doing that. What it means is that we also have to investigate each case, and not only the IEC, but anybody who thinks that the code has been violated may approach the ordinary courts, the police, or the electoral court to vindicate their rights.
Well, the warning certainly has been sounded. Thank you very much indeed for joining us from the Independent Electoral Commission Commissioner, Judge Daya Pillay.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Department of Home Affairs has at last issued new work visa regulations that will make it easier for skilled foreigners to come and work in this country. The regulations, gazetted on the eve of the Easter weekend, now introduce new remote work visas for foreigners earning more than 1 million rand a year and who want to relocate into South Africa. They also introduce a point system to replace the controversial critical skills list. In conversation now with Marissa Jacobs, she's managing director of the consultancy Expat Web that works in the space. Marissa, welcome to you. So how do these new regulations work?
So the new regulations really, they've actually come into effect since last year, April already, through some directives that the Department of Home Affairs issued, but the regulations now bring those directives into law. And the two things that it does in terms of requirements is it's taken away the need for an applicant to submit a radiological report. So that's after they've done a chest x-ray, which Operation Bulandlela, when they reviewed the immigration process, just said it's an outdated requirement. It doesn't serve a purpose anymore. Let's remove this from the requirements. So that's the one thing. And then the other thing, and I think probably more importantly, is the police clearance certificates. So in the past, a person would have to submit a police clearance from every country they've resided since their 18th birthday for 12 months or more. So for a lot of senior executives, you can imagine they work all around the world. It becomes a long list of police clearances that they need to submit. Some countries, it's very difficult to get a police clearance certificate. You're not able to apply for it online or remotely. You have to do fingerprints. So it's a tedious process, and they've now reduced that to say you only need a police clearance certificate from countries you've lived in for the past 5 years. So that brings it down to one, maybe two certificates for most applicants, really making it easier and less onerous to attract skills to the country.
And Marissa, am I correct in saying that there is a new point system, or have I read that wrong?
There is a point system. It hasn't been clarified yet, so they've introduced it into the regulations to say that there will be a point system for consideration, but there will need to be further gazetting in terms of what that will look like. If you read these regulations, you'll see it's extremely vague, and it doesn't actually bring into effect the point system. It just introduces it to say that there is a point system, that they're considering it, and that there will be further notice by the minister in terms of exactly how that will work.
And there's something called the Trusted Employer System. Are you able to tell me about that?
Absolutely. So the Trusted Employer Scheme was gazetted at the end of last year. Applications opened up, and it fully came into effect on the 1st of March. So just about a month old now. There was about 68 employers that were approved as trusted employers. And this is really significant for the immigration regime in South Africa. What it's done is it's given privileges to those 68 trusted employers who needed to go through a rigorous process to get approved as a trusted employer. And what it gives them now is it gives them certain waivers. So it reduces the requirements for trusted employer right down to really the bare minimum requirement of documents. So they're able to mobilize talent very quickly. And what the department has done is they put the onus on the employer to say, they must make sure that all the balances and checks are in place in terms of verifying qualifications, verifying professional body registration, and the department will issue the work visa in good faith, and they will audit those employers on a regular basis to make sure that in the background they have been doing these checks. And the additional thing that they've done, which is significant in terms of the backlog, is they've guaranteed them shorter processing times. So because there's less requirements, they're able to process those visas within 10 days and issue them. So significant advantage for those approved as a trusted employer.
So what I'm hearing more broadly is that this pipeline now has been unblocked. Do you still have concerns, or are there still worries, or are there still risks to the system that you need to take cognizance of?
So I think definitely we sit with the inherent backlog, which has not gone away. So certainly the Trusted Employer Scheme will help to not add more to the backlog, because there's a separate flow for those applications. But those applications that are stuck in the backlog, they're still stuck there, and there's still issues with resources to get through that backlog, and we're still seeing very slow movement on employers who are waiting long for applications. So that's still a significant concern. I think something that I can add as well in terms of the new regulations that have been published is the introduction of the new remote worker visa. That is something that a couple of countries have introduced. It's been on the cards for South Africa for many years, and these draft regulations that have now been published bring into effect the remote worker visa. So you can now, as of last week Thursday, apply for a remote worker visa to come and work remotely in South Africa, which I think is another big win.
Thank you very much for joining me, Marissa Jacobs, MD of the consultancy Expat Web. I appreciate it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
New research from the Futures Ecosystems for Africa program, it's based at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg, has found that Africa has now transitioned from being a slight net carbon sink to a net carbon source. So what does that mean and why is it important? I'm joined now by Yolandi Ernst, who is a researcher in systems ecology at the university. Yolandi, welcome. So very quickly, can you explain the difference?
So, Jeremy, that is a very good question, and I think a very basic thing to understand. So, if we talk about a carbon sink, that is processes or things that draw down carbon from the atmosphere and store it within plants. Usually, it's in our ecosystems. We have different processes that do that. So, the stores and the carbon sinks are usually our ecosystems where our vegetation and soil store and process the carbon. Then our sources are the things that release carbon and greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, where it causes climate change through global warming.
So what has caused the shift as far as South Africa is concerned?
Well, for South Africa, we actually did a study across the whole of Africa, and mostly it's fossil fuels and also land use change, where we are transforming a lot of our land into agricultural fields for food production. And through that, we are plowing up the natural stores and we are releasing the carbon and also putting things into the ground like fertilizers that cause additional greenhouse gas releases.
So it's an inevitable consequence, I imagine, of progress.
Yes, of course. I mean, Africa is a growing population. We will keep on expanding and people will need land to grow food. And the thing is that we will continue on this path if we don't do something now. I think it's important to note that there are ways that we can, you know, mitigate this, but it will, you know, take a lot of effort from a global perspective.
And part of that, I imagine, is greater investment in carbon neutral energy sources.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if we really invest in what is available at the moment and we put our efforts into that, we can reduce the carbon emissions by up to 30%. But as I said, the land use conversion is actually more of a concern at this stage, just because it really, you know, it has the potential to take away our carbon stores as much as it also releases greenhouse gases.
When we're talking about land use, we're talking about methane emission from livestock and what else?
Well, croplands, we have fertilizers that are going into the fields, and then also the fact that we are disturbing the natural ecosystems. So a lot of the carbon is stored within soils, and the moment we plow it up and transform our lands, we take away that carbon storage and we release that carbon into the atmosphere.
And as far as the continent is concerned, this transition from carbon sink to carbon source also has a negative impact, I imagine, on the broader global fight against climate change.
Absolutely. I mean, Africa has actually been amazing for providing this carbon sink service for such a long time. And it's the only continent that did it quite, you know, consistently. But at the moment, you know, it's concerning because the rest of the globe kind of depended on us to keep on providing that service. But all is not lost. I think, you know, this study is really important to let people know, listen, this is the time to to provide funding to invest in Africa and to do it in a way that is really sustainable and that can help not only Africa but also the rest of the world.
But that's part of the problem. It's always about finding funding and perhaps even more importantly, the actual commitment to make the change, which isn't always there. You've got to find that balance between economic imperative and growth on the one hand and climate protection on the other.
Exactly. It's a difficult problem, but I think it can be overcome. I think the world is really at a stage where they realize they have to, you know, invest in these things. And Africa should be taking the opportunity to be creative and to be innovative in terms of how we sustain our land, our ecosystems, and to take that money and do something good to improve livelihoods and to improve our whole sink capacity again.
And part of that innovative approach that you refer to, I imagine, would also include better conservation. And that's making sure that we protect natural ecosystems like grasslands, savannas and forests in sequestering carbon. But again, that's also going to take time, money and commitment.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the most important things for us to do is to protect and manage and restore the landscapes that are, you know, providing processes. And, you know, one thing that is quite, you know, controversial is the fact that people just want to start planting trees in Africa, which, I mean, it could not all be bad, but that has to be done very, very carefully, because in the end, you have to have the processes and not just the trees. These can really conflict with, you know, our attempts to preserve biodiversity.
Thank you very much.
But yes, money.
Always about the money, isn't it? Always about the money.
Yeah,
Yolandi Ernst,
the money.
researcher, systems ecology at WITS here in Johannesburg. Thank you very much for joining me and for the explanation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A fight is underway to save Wild Earth. It's the speciality channel that is in a pay dispute with the MultiChoice company. I'm joined now by Andre Crawford Brunt, who is chair of Wild Earth. Andre, first of all, why is the channel so popular and what's the fight about?
Jeremy, thank you very much for having me. Wild Earth has been around as a company for a number of years, close to 16 years, over 16 years, I beg your pardon. We're pioneers in doing live safari. So we're on multiple platforms. The most famous one and the one we're probably going to talk about is DSTV Channel 183. Our core product are our daily live safaris. So we do a sunrise and a sunset safari. And we are kind of, the phrase I've sort of termed is the largest safari vehicle in the world. You'll be familiar. Having been on safari, you can put six, maybe seven people on the back of a safari vehicle. We figured out a way to put a camera and enable 6 to 7 million unique viewers from all around the world to be able to go on a live and interactive safaris. You're able to ask questions. It's as if you're sitting on the back of the vehicle. And, you know, we kind of have been pioneers in the space, so, and built a really large and passionate audience globally.
So you have now a conflict with MultiChoice over the continuation of the service. What's the issue here?
Well, the real issue, and again, just a little bit of background, 3-odd years ago, predating my involvement in the company, the management of Wild Earth did a deal with MultiChoice. MultiChoice took a gamble on Wild Earth at the time, and part of that deal was that we would appear on Channel 183. We actually had to pay various broadcasting fees. We paid them about 10-odd million rand for the pleasure of being on their channel. As they've highlighted in their press statement, it was non-exclusive, and, you know, we would receive the benefits of advertising from that. About a year or so ago, I recognized that we'd built an incredibly large audience and had become a staple diet. A lot of people watch on 183. About a third of our viewers in total are South African. We did a survey in Q4 of last year, and 10,000 viewers responded, and 88% of them sort of watched on DSTV or DSTV streaming. You know, they told us we were their top local content channel. They told us in the top 3 channels on MultiChoice, and 90% voted us their top wildlife channel. So we've really done a lot of work around understanding our audience, understanding their engagement, Jeremy. And what we found is, you know, that we've got this very large audience, passionate audience. You know, they're under the impression they pay subscriptions to DSTV. And, you know, somewhere the viewers believe we're getting paid for our content. We've never been paid a penny by MultiChoice. Over the last year, I've been engaged in a dialogue with them because, frankly, our vision should be completely aligned. You know, their big focus is on local content. No one produces more local content than us. We're promoting tourism in the country. We're promoting education. We're promoting conservation. It's everything good. We're non-political, family-friendly, very long viewing times in the TikTok world that we live in. And we just represent an escape to nature. And I'd argue there's never been a time where our human need for nature connection has been, on the one hand, more eroded or more important. Right. And this has ended up in us taking a stand because after a year of backwards and forwards and we love you guys and we want to get together, we want to build this thing with you, you know, they've just kept kicking the can and kicking the can down the road. And we needed to make the difficult decision. And that was, you know, we're going to come off the channel unless we're able to get some compensation, because we know what we do is valuable. And we think you guys receive a large amount of money under the auspices of people being able to watch our content on your channel, and not receiving anything seems really unfair to us.
So what type of compensation are you looking for? And is there any room here to compromise given the popularity of the channel?
So one would hope so. I mean, one of the viewers launched a survey, Jeremy, and there are multiple surveys now, you know, begging MultiChoice to do the right thing. You know, they're north of 16,000 signatures. In the UK, if you get a petition with more than 10,000 signatures, the government is obliged to respond. You know, we're not in the UK and we're not dealing with the government. We're dealing with MultiChoice. They've not responded. They said they're not going to engage in a slanging match. You know, there is no slanging, just to be clear. I have the highest regard and respect. And frankly, people within MultiChoice have reached out to me, you know, who are horrified at the state of play and some of the things that are going on here, and what looks to be just gross unfairness or gross miscalculation in terms of the risk reward for them having just increased prices in April. We believe that, you know, as South Africans, we should be supporting one another. African content comes from Africa. So paying dollars to big American media houses for African content, you know, which has been packaged by teams that fly in here, produce it, then, you know, send it off and sell it back to us, just in our view feels to be wrong. Now, we're not comparing ourselves and to a whole host of others. We've got an audience that likes what we do. You know, as I said, we're pioneers, and what we do is interactive. It's unique. It's live. You know, hopefully you viewed the channel and you're a fan. But we just think on that level, you know, MultiChoice in some way should at least give their side of the view. We're hosting a town hall at 7 p.m. on Friday. It's what we do regularly for our viewers and our fans. We're going to do that on all platforms. One of them is DSTV. I invited the CEO as well as the chair to attend to give their side of the story, and they've declined, even with the kind of caveat that we could agree the questions in advance. They've decided that that's less important to them.
So let me ask you this question then. What would be fair compensation as far as Wild Earth is concerned?
We've got a burn, which obviously is our revenues minus our costs. We're continuing to lose money. And in order to run a business, you know, we work particularly hard to get that burn down. But unless you're able to create a sustainable business model, there is no Wild Earth at the end of the day. And, you know, we think there is a definite win-win that could be created here. Wild Earth off DSTV is a lose for DSTV. It's a lose for their viewers who pay subscription. It's a lose for our channel, in our view. And, you know, that would be the worst case scenario. Now, we're the people who made the decision, so full disclosure, to take it off channel 183. But frankly, that is to force people to come together and to figure out how we solve something. And if something's important enough, ultimately it will get resolved. Putting your head in the sand and ignoring the outcome, ignoring your viewers, you know, there are now 40,000. We've gone through all the social media posts. There are 40,000 social media posts on this. 8,000 allude to people, MultiChoice subscribers, saying they're going to cancel their subscription. So, you know, so somewhere within MultiChoice, you would think someone would say, hang on a second, you know, if I'm a non-exec or I sit on the board or, you know, I'm a leader within the company, you know, have we analyzed this? Is this clear? How is our allocation of resource? What is the right thing we can do?
So at that point, Andre Crawford-Brunt, Chair of Wild Earth, thank you very much for joining us. Obviously, we will reach out to MultiChoice as well, but thanks for putting your side of the story to us. I do appreciate it. And that's where we are going to leave it for this Friday, MoneyWeb at Midday. We are live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Have a good weekend.